Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Why do you think I went to all this trouble? Why do you think I want money so badly?
All right, why?
Are you sure you want to know?
Yes.
Then I'll tell you. With this money, I can get away from you.
Vito.
From you and your chickens and your pies and your kitchens and everything that smells of grease. I can get away from this shack with its cheap furniture and this town and its dollar days and its women that wear uniforms and its men that wear overalls.
Vita, I think I'm really seeing you for the first time in my life, and you're cheap and horrible.
You think just because you made a little money you can get a new hairdo and some expensive clothes and turn yourself into a lady. But you can't, because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing. With this money, I can get away from every rotten, stinking thing that makes me think of this place or you.
I want to. You got to give it to us dramatic.
Yeah, right. Hello and welcome.
There we go.
To the Sun Cinema Podcast, a weekly radio show that examines the highs and lows of the medium of film through the filtered lens of Washington, D.C.'s only art house cinema, Sun Cinema. I'm your host, Jason Cawley, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ryan Hunter Mitchell.
Jason.
Ryan.
We've got no David.
We have no David yet again.
He's
2 weeks in a row.
He's been busy.
Should I start building hologram David?
Maybe.
Actually.
Yeah. That would be awesome.
All right.
Yeah. Let's do that. It's good to have holograms of us. You know, it's 2019.
You never know.
Right.
That was Anne Blythe telling off Joan Crawford. And
yeah.
You know, we're only giving her side of the story because I hear Joan Crawford gets a few jabs in as well.
Yeah, she makes her way through this film. Mildred Pierce, 45,
yeah. I believe. Showing this Sunday at Sun Cinema.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
what's going on?
Yeah, it's June. Welcome to June.
Gosh, it's June.
It's been warm. It's beautiful out. Happy Pride, everybody, all around the country. Riots can turn into widely celebrated celebrations, national celebrations, the globe over. So this month we're doing Outrageous and Unacceptable is the title of the month, which I think is pretty in our wheelhouse at Suns, but it was kind of fun to put together this way. I wish David were here to talk about it. But he had joked after the Met Gala had done camp this year. He's like, should we do a camp month? But I think we also thought that was kind of corny.
I think, in
a fine way.
Sure. No. I think this is a little bit like what you guys have done. If you go, you know, to the Sun Cinema Facebook page or Instagram, you know, whatever, you can see the calendar for the month. And it's kind of, when I first saw it, it kind of took me aback a little bit, just because I couldn't really, I guess, make immediate sense of it, you know.
Yeah.
And then when I kind of took it as a whole, I was like, oh no, this makes perfect sense. Like, it's a good mix of, like, you know, truly outrageous stuff like the Ed Wood stuff, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, shortly, but you know, the Russ Meyer things. I mean, like, there's a lot of cool out there John Waters-ish type stuff, and then there's also, like, some really truly, like, great melodramas, which we're going to talk about at length a little bit more today.
That's what was kind of fun. You know, I'm not an expert on camp, but I have read the Susan Sontag's notes on camp, and she's just a great media critic, social critic.
Sure.
One of the best of kind of the 60s and
70s. Of her generation, for sure.
And I think camp, I can't speak to it much, but it had been around for a while and people had been kind of noticing camp. And it is fun to think of, it's not just an aesthetic, it's really a sensibility. It's a way of, it is, a lot of it is in the eye of the beholder. And when that becomes a community, looking at things that might be very serious and finding either a humor or a certain very over-the-top aesthetic.
An absurdity.
An absurdity. And it is a hard-to-place sensibility and aesthetic, because it's not just absurdist, and it's not completely just censored. It is outrageous and unacceptable.
Yeah. Nice tie-in. No, I think you're absolutely right, and I feel like you hit on kind of the chord with camp in general there, which is like a developed community that happens kind of over time. Like, you know, mm-hmm. John Waters is widely, you know, heralded now as like one of the great filmmakers of the last 40, 50 years, but this is a guy who, you know, really started with a very, very small following, you know, sure. that just kind yeah. of developed. And then even people who weren't immediately drawn into that world necessarily were able to, over time, understand his aesthetic and go, okay, now I get what I'm getting yeah, into. Yeah. And it's not so, I don't want to say abrasive, but it's not such a shock to the system when you go see a John Waters film if you know what you're walking into.
Yeah. If you know someone might be eating dog shit in this movie,
right.
All right, you're kind of prepared.
Yeah, there is always that chance.
Yeah, always. Well, speaking of John Waters, he was in town at Politics yeah. and Prose very recently. And if you check out Sun Cinema Instagram, a fan of the cinema got a picture of John Waters holding our calendar. And it looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
No, I'm going to say it's a full-on endorsement.
John Waters, friend of the podcast.
Friend of the podcast. John Waters, Joan Crawford, friends of the podcast, right. helping us out.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's look at some of the titles. I don't want to go through it too much, but we did show Faster Pussycat Kill Kill last Saturday, which is, John Waters has said, it's probably the greatest movie that will ever be made.
Certainly, like, the most impactful thing on him. You can see it immediately, you know?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's one that's been something we've wanted to show since early on, and it, you know, really fit this month as a good kickoff for this month. So
it's perfect.
Found a good spot. Then we showed Ed Wood's Glenn or Glenda on Sunday, which I haven't seen, but I like this little tidbit about Ed Wood. This is Ed Wood, the filmmaker behind Glenn or Glenda and Plan 9 from Outer Space, the author of hundreds of adult novels, a pallbearer at Bela Lugosi's funeral. Wood fought in the Pacific Ocean Theater during World War II while wearing a bra and panties under his uniform. Basically, there will never be another hero like Ed Wood.
Beautiful. Where did you find that?
Do
you
know, the internet.
Yeah, just
probably
internet.
None of it's true.
Right.
But Glenn or Glenda, that I believe was his first feature, where he plays a man who wants to explained to his wife that he is a woman, Glenda. Right. So pretty cutting edge at the time. I think this was the 50s.
Yeah.
And it wasn't trans, because it wasn't really the language used at the time, but it definitely is was pushing boundaries.
Yeah, and I mean, not just like in content, but just in the way the films were being made. I mean, this was, you know, very, very low budget. And I mean, mm-hmm. he was a guy who kind of embraced that instead of, you know, kind of rearranging his story around it. He was just like, you know, it's going to be what it's going to be, and we're just going to go for it.
Yeah.
And he never kind of made excuses or apologies mm-hmm. for that, which, you know, ultimately gets people like John Waters and Tim Burton
or Russ Meyer or Roger Corman.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, all these guys were just, you know, on some level either directly influenced by him or owe him some sort of debt. You
definitely
know? I don't think he gets enough due just from the production side of his, you know, films.
Which I will give credit to Tim Burton, enemy of the podcast, for making the Ed Wood movie.
Yeah.
Tom Burton.
Whatever. Timmy Burton.
Yeah.
Thomas Burton.
Which is also, I mean, Martin Landau, who never gets enough credit in anything, in any conversation, also received his Best Supporting Actor Oscar for that, which... playing Bela Lugosi, which was pretty amazing.
And then on Mondays, Josh's series, this month he's doing movies that made him gay. And last night he did Bring It On, which I love all of the movies he's doing this month. Hopefully we can get him on the podcast to talk about his titles. But Bring It On was last night, and tonight is Rafiki, which we're super excited about. But now let's get into melodrama.
Yeah, which is kind of lined up on your Sundays as well.
Yeah.
Certainly. And then there's some, I feel like there's, you know, some great stuff in there. Douglas Sirk stuff in there, which kind of has to happen, you know, for melodrama to be there.
I'm not super familiar, but I've always, you read about him being the one who pulled off melodrama pretty universally.
Yeah, more than I would say really anybody. I mean, the whole thing with like Douglas Sirk, okay? Douglas Sirk was the first guy who really, I think, in the kind of post-World War II era, consistently just showed like great, deep, thoughtful roles for women, which was not a thing, and putting them solely in the lead, you know, I mean, okay, like unequivocally the lead in this movie. Jane Wyman, I mean, just had some of her greatest stuff, you know, came from Douglas Sirk films. The stuff she did with Rock Hudson in those films were amazing. And I mean, like, talk about a guy who's had impact all the way down from, you know, Tarantino has talked about him endlessly. Probably most notably Todd Haynes, who made the film Safe, Far From Heaven, mm-hmm. and oddly enough, Mildred Pierce, the TV series with the miniseries he did with Kate Winslet.
Yeah,
that's Todd Haynes. And he unabashedly, like, says Douglas Sirk is it. If you're familiar with Rainer Werner Fassbinder,
which we are showing,
Fury, you know, Ali, Fury to Soul. I mean, all of this stuff.
We'll be showing Fox and His Friends.
Fox and His Friends, so good. Openly says Douglas Sirk was the biggest influence on him. Directly, Todd Haynes has said the same.
Which are the big Douglas Sirk movies?
I would say three that you probably want to start with is All That Heaven Allows, 1955. And I think you guys are playing Imitation of Life, right, on Sunday?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, 1959. And then
on the 23rd.
Then I would say the last one is the one that was made in between those called Written on the Wind. If you're going to see three, like if you're going to get into Douglas Sirk, like those are the three to kind of go after, and you'll really understand kind of where he is. He is oddly, I wouldn't say credited, but at least hinted at in a lot of television arenas as kind of the jumping off point, don't laugh, for soap operas.
Sure.
Came out of Douglas Sirk films. Like people were seeing that and were like, ooh, could we like extend that storyline?
Sure.
Because it's just kind of people living their lives, so we'll you know, soap operas kind of took that up a notch.
Yeah.
You know, and set it in some crazy settings, and you know, very rich people, and you know, like these interesting lives. But it was all, depending on who you're talking to, a lot of that was influenced and kind of brought about from Douglas Sirk. So his influence on melodrama maybe as big or bigger than anybody. Certainly bigger than most, and maybe as big as anybody out there.
Certainly in the 20th century.
Least post-war, I would say. Yeah, post-World War II.
So yeah, well, with melodrama, I suppose, like, just so everyone knows what we're talking about, we kind of mean the heightened emotion, acting, and plot devices to make it as emotional as possible, right?
Yeah, I think... It's one of those things when you hear melodrama, I think people hear it a whole lot, especially anybody who's in and around film hears it a whole lot, and you don't really put that into perspective or really maybe understand what that is. Uh-huh. And it just sounds like maybe something that's less than drama, or mm-hmm. it's not quite great. You know, melodrama just doesn't sound like it's going to be great. And that's just completely wrong. You know,
it almost sounds like it's kind of, you know, brushing it off a little bit, calling something a melodrama.
Well, and like, I mean, it's obviously a knock on someone if you're calling them quit being so melodramatic and all of these things. So it's gotten this kind of bad connotation, which in reality, it's just, you know, kind of a dramatic story, heightened dramatic story told with kind of, you know, these archetype characters. Mm-hmm. But again, one of those things, I mean, like, from Douglas Sirk to, let's say, somebody today like Pedro Almodovar.
Sure.
You know, 100% melodrama. You know, Pedro Almodovar.
Yeah.
100% melodrama. Humongous big characters, you know, mm-hmm. that are kind of looking at a point in time in their life, whether it's, you know, something like All About My Mother or Julieta or...
Any of them. Yeah,
really great, like Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Mm-hmm. Like, here, we're going to take these, you know, group of characters, kind of heighten them up a little bit, and look at this one interesting moment in time in their life. And that's just great melodrama. And I mean, for, you know, decades and decades since the beginning of film, and certainly, you know, post World War II, you can look at just, I've got a list of about 20 directors here who I think are like great on that list. Everybody from like Michael Curtiz to Mike Mills to Barry Jenkins to Ingmar Bergman. You know, I mean, like, there are people that kind of fall into this category in a bunch of ways.
Also, something about the category is that it's not just that, because a lot of movies try to up the stakes and make the setting, you know, have all this weight to make the movie more important.
Sure.
Melodrama is doing this with the actors, and like you said, you're looking at a specific point of someone's life. It's not maybe going to change the whole world,
right?
So everything has to be a little dramatized, because you're, what you're focusing on is these specific small scenarios that these people are interacting with and how important it is to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's not necessarily a war movie where the weight of the movie and the importance of the movie is the mass, the magnitude of everything. It's really the magnitude of the acting and the importance on the emotional trials they're going through.
It's the human experience, right? Uh-huh. I mean, that's what we're really like examining in a melodrama.
Definitely.
It's just the human experience. And I mean, there are so many people, so many great directors who've, you know, do that well today, and certainly did it, you know, well for years. I mean, Noah Baumbach is another example of like, you know, I know he gets the kind of mumblecore and all of that, but like, amazing at just taking like a group of people in a scenario and like, hey, let's look at them for 3 days and this you know, and see what that looks like.
And he's able to like pass it off as like, oh no, this is almost realistic, which often melodrama is kind of considered unrealistic, but he is very much using their experiences to throw in some overacting. You kind of believe it, which I guess is what a good director can do.
I think one of the greatest guys doing that today, and you're showing one of his films this month as well, is I always butcher his last name, Luca Guadagnino. Bigger Splash.
I don't think we're showing that Bigger Splash.
Oh, you're not.
We're showing the one about David Hockney, and this has been, I should correct this right now, we're showing the 1970s documentary about David Hockney.
Wow, I didn't even know that.
Sorry, that's folks. I'm noticing this become
well, because it fits so well into the stream, you know?
It completely fits, and it is the exact same title. But no, we're maybe let's just do a double feature.
Right, perfect.
You heard it here.
It's going to happen. But he is.
But yes.
Call Me By Your Name, A Bigger Splash, I Am Love, all those things. It's, you know, interesting group of people in a setting for a certain period of time.
And like heightened acting and heightened plot points.
It just brings that when it's done extremely well, when the writing is amazing and the directing is great and you get the cast you need. The performances just go through the roof. I mean, it's one of those things like the audience, the critics, and the award circuit like love melodrama. You know, because you can really examine a performance in a melodrama because there's so much of it. You know, you're just focused on these people and what they're going through. And it's usually relationship driven. You know, it's not like you said, them trying to take that hill or we got to get this ship, you know, across the Atlantic, or we've got to do some amazing task or some hilarious thing. It's usually something interpersonal, very, you know, strong emotional content. And, you know, you're going to play that out over 90 minutes or 120 minutes. So you're getting a lot of screen time. And a lot of acting is happening.
They have to turn it into taking that hill.
Right.
In this small vacuum of a you know, marital drama or something, they'll have to make it as important as that.
I think Mike Mills is one of those guys that does that maybe as well as anybody right now with stuff like Beginners that he did in 2010. If you haven't seen Beginners, oh my God, see Beginners. Okay. 20th Century Women, he does it again just beautifully. And like, same thing. I mean, like, Academy Award nominations come out of these films. You know, they come out of Todd Haynes films like Far From Heaven and obviously, you know, other nominations from Mildred Pierce and Golden Globes, whatever. But like Mike Lee, the British filmmaker, Secrets and Lies from 96. Life is Sweet, he did in like 90. And then another year in 2010. Great, like Douglas Sirk style and level melodrama. You know, small stories, compact. small cast, but just like dynamic performances coming at you. And, you know, again, James Ivory, you know, Ivory Merchant Films, you know, okay. Brilliant at doing that. Stuff like Howard's End and A Room with a View and Remains of the Day. I mean, are just tremendous melodrama. And you get these amazing kind of Emma Thompson, you uh-huh. know, heavy performances out of it.
But do you think this is where the knocking the melodrama and the melodramatic acting comes from? Is when, if it's not pulled off, you've psyched yourself into thinking that you're selling something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
then it could just look completely ridiculous.
It can. I mean, it does. It happens, you know, I would say the majority of the time.
Yeah. Even, yeah.
It just doesn't quite work, you know. And whether it's like absurdist or something where you're truly just, you know, can't believe you paid money to watch this movie or sat down to watch this, sometimes it's not even that it's an awful thing. It just doesn't quite get there, you know. So for me, when you look at like great melodramatic stuff, you realize like, oh, the level of, you know, that you have to be bringing when you're coming at this from the writing, from the acting and the directing, you know, you really, it's only these couple of dozen of great, you know, great, great filmmakers who are able to pull this off really well.
Douglas Sirk, Tommy Wiseau.
No, but like truly like the Jane Campions of the world and the Michael Curtiz, you know, of the world, Billy Wilder. I mean, you know, there's just a ton of great people. Bergman, to an extent, one way or another,
yeah,
his stuff
definitely.
Can be a little trippier and, uh-huh. and a little more out there. But stuff like Summer with Monica.
Yeah, I was going to say, that one is actually pretty
phenomenal. And I think like Autumn Sonata, which is, you know, this great story about a mother and daughter. And it's like one location mm-hmm. in this house, very Douglas Sirk style. It's amazing.
Virgin Spring is a classic almost melodrama.
Yeah, and Cries and Whispers with the sisters on the estate, the one sister's dying. I mean, it's amazing.
So let's go through like what are some of the 30s are kind of when melodramas are breaking into film as like the talking. Maybe there were silent film melodramas, I'm sure.
Oh,
as well,
no, for sure.
But so as we're getting the talking movies, the talking pictures, that's kind of the breakout of a lot of the big melodrama, right? Is it?
Well, that's what it allowed for, right? It allowed for sound, which allowed for dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what was lacking. Nobody wants to sit and read title cards all day, sure. you know, in a silent movie.
It loses something.
Yeah, you start getting pulled out a little bit when people are just back and forth. But, you know, the invention of sound with cinema actually allowed for that dialogue to happen. And once you had that, then you could have a more theatrical type of film. Where you had a lot of dialogue, a lot of talking, you know, that just couldn't exist without sound.
Sure.
So that's what really brought it in. And the early people like Joan Crawford who brought us in, you know, certainly Betty Davis, Barbara Stanwyck early
Greta
on.
Greta Garbo,
Marlena Dietrich, you know, Olivia de Havilland. These people early in the 30s and 40s. Specifically just kind of set the standard for everybody since. Just amazing at it. That's all I got.
Yeah, that's all you got. Okay, well then, can you... I've not seen Mildred Pierce. I've watched that clip that mm-hmm. we played earlier, which was wonderful. Can you tell us a bit about Mildred Pierce? Because we're going to be playing that. Can you tell us about the movie that we're going to be playing?
Yeah, I will tell you a couple of things. One, it was 1945. Two, there's this amazing backstory, and I will try to find this. I don't know if we can link to stuff, Jack, or not, the way we're set up. But
we can.
Yeah, we can add it on our show notes.
I will find a link that I feel like if you're interested in anything that we've been talking about or what I'm about to say regarding Mildred Pierce is amazing. There's this... YouTube channel called, it's a little misleading, called Be Kind Rewind.
Love that movie.
Yeah, I do too. But it's actually just kind of a look at women in film over time.
Okay.
And it kind of uses the Oscars as a jumping off point, which sounds a little like, okay, I've kind of got it. But the level of backstory and quality, these are like 15, 20 minute clips. Are just amazing. Like there's a 16 minute one I'll link to in our podcast about Joan Crawford and Mildred Pierce and how basically she was a contract player. she, despite her looks and everything and her great talent, like never really, really took off in the way that she wanted to. She was kind of getting hemmed in with, you know, just kind of being typecast as almost like the second girl in a movie, like, you know, very pretty, very smart, but not quite going to get the guy, you know, that kind of person. And she, you know, despite having some starring stuff, 1944 or so, was kind of dead in the water, and she had cut off her contract. I want to say with Warners, but wherever she was, MGM, Warners, Fox, but she decided, like, this is Mildred Pierce. She got the script from Mildred Pierce and was like, this is what I want. This is going to, and everybody was like, not only are we not interested in this film, we're certainly not interested in you being in this film. And so once it kind of took off, Michael Curtiz, you know, she got Michael Curtiz on board, who was coming off 3 years earlier, just done Casablanca, not a bad film.
Yeah.
Certainly a great melodrama. And, you know, pulled this thing together, but it's basically, you know, hardworking mother in, you know, California, divorces her husband, starts her own restaurant, becomes a huge success, thinks she's going to kind of bring her daughter up in this much better world and much better life, and kind of ultimately builds this awful daughter, you know, who she brings up,
as
who
we
wants,
do.
Yeah, who wants no part of her life, surprise, surprise. And, you know, some darker kind of film noirish almost things take place, putting Joan Crawford's Mildred Pierce in just a really, really odd situation that kind of, without giving anything away, like, wonder how she's going to get out of this thing. How she's going to get out of this nightmare. Great film. You know, really good blend of, like, kind of melodrama, crime, film noir even.
Yeah, dark.
You know, yeah, very, you know, dark at times, but just level of production was through the roof. It's an amazing film to look at, actually. Certainly, if you get the chance, it's a great place to start for melodrama for Joan Crawford. Wherever you want to go from there is not a bad place.
So with Joan Crawford, that's one of the things, I think her performance specifically in Mildred Pierce is one of the things Susan Sontag mentions, is like about how her acting in that is undeniably camp. And even though she sells it, she does it really well. That's a fun aspect of the, if you're saying camp, is that it's not a joke. It's like you really sell it and it's sincere, and then you can appreciate it as this great sincere role, but you can also appreciate it as like, this is over the top.
Yeah,
this is so much.
Well, I think camp falls into the same camp. Ha ha. As far as
we need some sound effects.
Yes.
Yeah, really nice. That took me so off guard there.
Oh dear God. So anyway, I was going to say camp falls into the same category as farce, where to me, like, if you, the only way to do it, you can't wink at it, right?
Uh-huh.
The second you kind of acknowledge that you're going for camp or you're going for farce, it's over. You've lost it. Like, it has to be like full commitment, you know?
It's like playing chicken in the road.
Yeah. I'll use a TV reference. But if you guys have not been watching Schitt's Creek, by the way,
I'm not caught up, but it is one of the better shows.
Oh, my God. And Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah.
Like, talk about farce and camp.
Definitely.
And, like, just goes for it. 100% commitment. Uh-huh. And it works. You know, because she's just so in, you know?
If she did not... she's so over the top. But if she held back at all, it would just kind of fall flat.
It falls flat. Like, she has to be larger than life. And she has... The only way to, like, pull that off and be humorous and actually have some sort of heart is to be 100% committed. And when you get people who are willing to do that, like Catherine O'Hara or Joan Crawford, you get great performances.
Yeah.
You know?
So with like noir, now a lot of us will consider noir to be pretty melodramatic, but at the time I think they kind of thought they were playing it cool and really kind of doing a change up from the melodramatic acting and being a little more,
it was
sly.
Grittier.
Yeah, they're trying to be grittier. And then that does kind of feed into, we get Italian neorealismo, we get the French New Wave, and all of a sudden grit is in for a while, and melodrama, yeah, aside from like TV, starts taking a lot.
TV took it in the 60s
and the 70s. I mean, Gore Vidal leaves being a historian to start writing telenovelas.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, no, this is the money. This is fun.
Yep.
So yeah, TV kind of runs with it, but it's not really the big movie thing for a while. Kind of through the 70s. Are there any real intentional? I guess.
I think it was. There were still people, obviously you don't really associate some of these folks with the 70s, but like Bergman's stuff that was very melodramatic was stuff that was happening in 72, 78.
Obviously, it's not really mainstream.
Yeah, yeah, not really mainstream. I would say somebody that was mainstream that kind of fell into that category, certainly heavy comedies on the front end, but you know, I know he's like persona non grata, but Woody Allen does that as well as anybody. Yeah. I mean, Hannah and Her Sisters in the 80s, you know, Crimes and Misdemeanors, but even Annie Hall and Manhattan and some of those 70s films really strike a chord of, you know, oh, well, this is, you know, it is kind of melodrama.
They're also a little self-aware.
Yeah, you know, for sure.
It still has that 70s self-awareness. I mean, it does both.
Right.
But it'll like nod that it knows that it's being dramatic or something.
Yeah, I mean, Woody Allen's hard to kind of, in the 70s especially, it's hard to kind of pin him in.
Yeah.
But certainly it was happening. But you're right. I think there was a regression there a little bit. Yeah, just times were changing and things fall out of fashion, right?
Yeah.
So it took until kind of the 90s for that to come back
or
around.
Or even like 80s. Creeping in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
De Palma.
Merchant Ivory.
Maybe. And,
yeah, yeah.
Like, even though those do up the stakes, but even something like Scarface, it is kind of a big picture, but it also has melodramatic aspects.
And the guys like Noah Baumbach, who loved De Palma. I mean, like, you see that. Like, that's where that comes from. A lot of that love is from stuff like Scarface or Dressed to Kill.
Yeah, they found new ways to kind of do this.
Almodovar, certainly in the
80s. 80s, 90s.
Yeah. Definitely kind of found his stride in the 80s with that. And then, like I said, I mean, there's a host of people that come in the 90s. Like we mentioned, Todd Haynes, Mike Leigh, Jane Campion, you know, falls into that category. I mean, just there's literally, you know, a host of people who are kind of refinding melodrama and making it work.
I came across this. Someone did a best rated R. I don't know where I can find these. It's like the top rated R melodramas, which kind of, okay, here we go. We're doing rated R. We're going off the map. But I did like that a lot of these are modern, and it is a fun way to look at melodrama. Number one, they pick Rain Man. I'm like, okay, all right, yeah, a little bit. Two, Sling Blade.
Really?
See, I guess those are kind of subtle. But is it over the top?
Yeah, I mean,
small character.
Yeah, that's tough.
Okay, Girl Interrupted. This one I'll give it.
Okay.
Dancer in the Dark? Huh.
Oh, Dancer in the Dark. All right.
Interesting, because in a way I see that it is, I mean, it's like depressing as hell and from the personal performances. Yeah. And like,
Lars von Trier's never made a happy movie, ever.
I wonder if that's what he thinks he's doing.
Yeah,
Nymphomaniac Part 1 was funny.
Oh my God.
That was kind of like
that is so dark, Jack.
I think it was Part 1 or Part 2. One of them was funny and then the other one got dark.
I didn't mind his How to Train Your Dragon. I thought it was kind of... okay, so now that I've like not been sold on any of these completely... Where do we see Dancer in the Dark as just like a new way of doing something? Because I could be convinced on that one specifically, even though von Trier is kind of not into the melodrama. But Dancer in the Dark, I mean, the acting is loud. It is certainly expressive. But
it's certainly
honest.
It's certainly like a small story too. I mean, like it's all taking place in this little town, and you know, you got these true kind of archetype characters, you know.
Yeah, and how she's getting burned, and how, I mean, it does play kind of like a 1950s, like someone kind of taking advantage of someone.
I guess, yeah. I mean, I never looked at Lars von Trier in that light.
Okay, here we have to do it. Cruel Intentions.
Cruel Intentions.
100%. I'll say that's a...
Sure.
That's a melodrama. Most of these, nothing else I even recognize on this list. All right. Thanks, Rated R with melodrama. thanks for Rain Man.
Yeah, no, I think
they just really wanted to mention that Rain Man is rated R. That's why he wrote that article.
Why would Rain Man be rated R?
I don't know.
I can't even remember. They're certainly not like abreast in there.
Or probably show.
Probably just some language.
Yeah.
Or something. Something
say the F word.
Yeah. Wow. Got to make Tom tough.
Okay. So, oh, I see on your list of, you got Barry Jenkins, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, I think.
I would definitely say.
Yeah. Look at something like Moonlight or Bill Street Could Talk. I mean, these are like modern melodrama.
Yeah. More than Dancer in the Dark.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, maybe. It certainly feels, you know, like a grittier version, you know, over some type of like Merchant Ivory type of thing or something, or even like a Douglas Sirk type of thing. But I would say it has just the same, it kind of plays the range of human emotions, tells it in a very, you know, small, compact way. Even something like Moonlight, which is transgressing over time and character, you know, it's still like this kid's journey, you know, being a black homosexual, uh-huh, growing up in the 90s and early 2000s. Yeah, I mean, I think that's, it makes for great melodrama. And, you know, of course, we get, you know, Oscar nominations out of it again. People love watching that.
And so the difference, I'd say, from If Beale Street Could Talk and Moonlight is I didn't really find the acting very melodramatic in Moonlight. But he kind of just sets a mood,
mm-hmm,
so well, and that's almost melodramatic. Certainly the plot points are,
right.
They're just like these three kind of strong, heavy, like, fulcrums. You know, when everything can change, is like a lot of weight on each moment. So the emotion's really heavy in that, but I haven't seen it as recently, but I remember it not being as like over the top or melodramatic acting.
Yeah, no, I would say it's
but it's there.
Yeah, it's very, it tries to be very realistic, yeah. But I think the tone of the film kind of falls
certainly
more into the melodrama.
Absolutely. You know? And If Beale Street Could Talk, that I would say, okay, then the performances become really loud.
Yeah.
Really emotive, really sad. A lot of like, if there's someone contemplating something, it's real quiet and there's a lot of eye contact.
Right.
So that one definitely has some melodramatic acting even in it, which gets Regina King the...
The Oscar.
Which
Oscars
she deserves.
Love melodrama. I mean, they just love it because we love those big performances.
Uh-huh.
You know, like you can just see, you know, whether it's Regina King or Betty Davis or something, just going for it. You
uh-huh
know, on All About Eve or something like, you know, where the actors are just all in and we're just, you know, they're giving a huge performance that, you know, for whatever reason, it's just working.
Yeah.
It matches the material, it matches the mood of the film, you know, and it just works.
One time where I could think of that felt kind of flat is, and I love Denzel Washington, but American Gangster, I think he thought he was getting the Oscar for it.
Like, oh, really? Yeah,
I think while he was shooting the movie, he's like, I'm taking this home, because he is just acting.
Right.
And he is such a good actor, but for whatever reason...
He's one of the greatest movie stars of all time.
That was kind of just on Ridley Scott's directing. I just thought that... didn't move around well, but I think that was trying to be this epic kind of,
yeah,
definitely melodramatic in the way that Godfather is or something.
Sure.
And it just the hunt is kind of fun in it, and
right,
the acting's good, but the movie just isn't there with it.
Well, it's one of those, I mean, I feel like this happens a lot, especially when you have a bunch of talented people, right? I mean, the sums just don't, or the parts don't add up to the whole, you know.
Yeah.
You just got great little things going on, but something's amiss, whether it's, you know, tonally or bad casting or the script's not quite right or the director's being too overindulgent in some cases, you know, whatever the case is, like all those little parts aren't adding up to a good movie. And that happens, I think, you know, if you look, soap opera is kind of a joke unto itself anymore, but when those things are really working, it's because everybody's on the same page, right? You know,
sure,
and everybody's kind of game for the type of performances we're going to give. The director knows the story he's going to tell, and he started with a script that, you know, kind of laid out those guidelines or parameters of where they were going to go from the start. Soap opera does that really well.
General Hospital nails it. Like, Lost didn't know what the hell it was doing.
Yeah, I mean, there is... call it whatever you want, but I mean, there's a reason these things have been on for 40, 50 years. You know, these shows continue because they just keep recycling, you know, known entities that work, you know, known storylines that are going to work.
And they have a fan base that they have a diehard fan base.
So strong.
So maybe we're just, maybe we do just move in these eras where we're willing to accept it. Cause I mean, not that soap operas have never really dwindled. They've been rocking. I know
they just keep crushing.
So many people who are like, if they work from home, they like have a break in the day where they watch, you know, Days of Our Lives.
Whatever.
So like, I know those are still going on, but I do think with TV kind of improving, becoming more prestige, a lot of these prestige shows are just, you know, more edited soap operas. Certainly Game of Thrones, Deadwood, Oz, all of these.
Any HBO, The Wire, HBO show, Sopranos.
Yeah, these are soap operas. They're really well done, but they're often melodramas too. They've just kind of figured out where what to use. But I do think it's coming into Netflix shows now. I think we are seeing like a return, if it's been gone, maybe I just haven't noticed, to melodramas and... You know, kind of let the overacting, let it have some fun.
Yeah, I mean it. I definitely think it kind of, you know, has peaks and valleys, especially on the cinema side. But there's room for everything. And it's kind of one of those things we were talking about, you know, just if it works, good is good. You know, so if your thing is melodrama, if you're Mike Mills or Noah Baumbach and... You know, this is kind of the world you exist in. Just be great at it, and we'll get on board. You know,
see, I'm afraid with movies, that's going to be less than it was in the past. Just because studios put out a few less movies a year than they did. You know, it's kind of like half. They put out like almost half the movies that they did 15 years ago.
Oh, sure.
So I wonder if we're still going to have the room, because I feel like the plan has been with the big franchise features is like instead of do the melodrama, it's just up the ante of the stakes of the plot.
Yeah.
Not exactly the plot devices, but literally, if this doesn't happen, the whole world falls apart.
And right.
So it's kind of, we're in franchise land right now. Maybe we're going to look back and like be like, okay, we overdid these and it kind of balances out and becomes room for smaller pictures, for smaller stories and melodramas. But I see it having more room in TV now, online TV than in movies.
Right. Where I would kind of thread the needle maybe with this conversation is to say there is room certainly in places where we kind of generally associate with TV, like Hulu or Netflix or Amazon, where those things are happening. Mike Mills makes his films with Amazon. Jim Jarmusch makes his films with Amazon. You know, who are we talking about? Just a bit ago. Oh, Baumbach. Does Netflix, you know, has a, what was it, the Meyerowitz Chronicles
and stuff.
You know, that's a Netflix movie.
Yep.
So, I mean, there are places where these things are still happening and can live. I side with you a little bit in the concern of, like, do they get lost in the noise? You know, do these smaller films really, because they're not really getting promoted unless they're you're on that site. Yeah, it's certainly not no studios putting, you know, or huge backers aren't putting money behind kind of talking melodrama, you know, small set piece kind of movies.
Maybe if someone nails it and like certain times in the past, that'll kind of bring on maybe a little trend of it, just like Young Guns did. We're waiting for the Young Guns of melodrama to hit the theaters.
Yeah.
All right, well, should we play a really great scene from a classic modern melodrama, a modern classic melodrama?
One of the best.
Jack, if you want to play us out on that other clip.
Oh, boy. Here it comes.
Yeah, sorry.
I can't talk right now.
Why, Lisa? Please talk to me, please. You're part of my life. You are everything. I could not go on without you, Lisa.
You're scaring me.
You are lying. I never hit you. You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
Why are you so hysterical?
Do you understand life?